You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of Late Night Live. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day, Gladys. Welcome to another Late Night Live. Scientologists have the sacred texts of Ron Hubbard to read. Jehovah's Witnesses, of course, are devoted to the Watchtower. Capitalist running dogs have many, many outlets of expression and inspiration, but I suppose you could focus on the Wall Street Journal. I, dear listener, am totally addicted to the New York Review of Books. If one doesn't come in this little plastic bag, regularly each month I go into tragic decline. But, and in fact, I think anyone who doesn't read it is nuts. And if you do, you occasionally see an Australian byline in this most influential of journals. Clive James pops up from time to time. Bob Hughes, once in a while. Peter Singer writes or is discussed in its pages. But far and away the most influential Australian contributor these days to the New York Review and to the public debate in the US from an Australian vantage point is Tim Flannery. Now, Tim's been popping in to talk to me on this program as long as I've been doing it. He's the most energetic young bloke. He's, of course, one of Australia's leading writers. He's a scientist, he's an explorer, he's a conservationist. 90 scientific papers to his credit. But he's... His writings in the New York Review lately have been so alarming, so profoundly disturbing, that I wanted to get him on to start at least with a chat about what he's been telling Americans, what he's been telling Americans about the environmental crisis. Because, of course, it has universal applicability and to us in Australia. But here's an Australian trying to alert Americans to a major problem. Now, Pat Robinson, who we often mention in the program, is the leader of the Christian Coalition. He's also America's most influential televangelist and a certifiable nut by any description. His view of the environmentalists is that they're the evil priests of a new paganism that will become the official state religion of the New World Order. But he's not alone in viewing them with concern. A recent poll had 41% of Americans considering environmental activists to be extremists. And another report has that most Americans share three common beliefs about environmental regulations and the economy. One is that environmental rules cause widespread unemployment. Another, environmental regulation has led to many plant shutdowns and aggravated unemployment at the local level. And the third belief is that environmental regulation has caused lots of companies to build new plants overseas. Now, Tim, if you're facing that sort of opposition, it's little wonder that the environmental movement in America has really not succeeded on too many of its major campaigns.
Well, yeah, I guess that's right, Philip. I mean, the most disturbing new trend, though, is this real collapse of the environmental movement in the US. And it's come about because a significant number of very influential Americans have decided that environmental activists and concern about the environment really are the enemy. And what you said about Pat Robinson has been disproportionately influential in the US, I think. I mean, in Australia, we can laugh at the idea that it, that you can go ahead and damage the environment and still be a patriot. But that, in fact, is the stance that a large number of right-wing Americans have taken. They despise the environment movement. They don't see cause for concern in the world around them in terms of environmental challenges. And I guess most importantly of all, they see that if we do take these concerns on, they'll become an impediment to the great economic engine that is America.
Tim, I remember one of Reagan's principal cabinet members who was responsible for matters environmental being a millenarian, being a great believer in the end times. And although he was notionally in control of the American landscape, his attitude seemed to be rape and pillage, we won't need it much longer. Is that also an ingredient?
Well, I think it is. It'd be interesting to get him back on the show now. It's 2005 and see if his views have changed. Perhaps he does think we're still in the end times. But you're right, it's that short-termism, that sense that there's no point worrying about the future. And for some people, that's expressed in a millennial-type cult. For others, it's this extraordinary belief in the capacity of technology to save the day. But whatever that belief is, it allows people to go on and do the most outrageous things and somehow justify it to themselves.
There is a sort of a quasi-religious faith in science. Let's look at that point you've just made. To what extent do you accept the proposition, and I know many scientists who take the view, that we can sort all these things out, that there are technical or scientific answers to these issues that are within our, almost a quick fix, almost a pill we can take?
Yeah, it's one of the most dangerous views in from my perspective that we face. And it's dangerous because in part it's proved to be true in the past. The rate of technological change is such that, you know, many of your listeners can remember when FJ Holdens were brand new things, you know, that when there was no thought, a world without computers, you know, things that we consider inconceivable today, and when cancer was a death sentence rather than the sort of treatable disease it's rapidly becoming. But what that view neglects to take on board is that when you look at the environment as a whole and the threats to that global environment, we're dealing with a multifaceted attack, really, on sustainability, which can bring about an irreversible collapse in terms of our environment that gives us, you know, clean air, clean water, food, all of the things we take for granted. And that sort of threat is not really amenable to a silver bullet technological solution. It's a grinding threat that each one of us progresses a bit further every day as we live these high-tech lives of ours where we consume lots and lots of energy and go on without thought about how that's impacting on the environment.
Your piece in the New York Review of August 11 is headed Endgame, which is a millenarian or apocalyptic notion in itself. Is that how seriously you view it?
Look, I should first point out I leave the titles to my pieces to Bob Silvers, the editor, because he's far better at that sort of stuff than I am. But I guess it is. I am very, very worried about the future of our planet and the future of my children, and in fact my future, really. The changes that we're seeing, particularly in respect to climate change, are so rapid now and so large that only an idiot would remain unconcerned.
But there are plenty of idiots who are gloriously unconcerned, as you're saying.
Yeah, well, there are.
Powerful idiots, people who have to be presidents of countries.
See, I take a bit more of a cynical view than that. I think that people like George Bush and John Howard are well informed on these matters, but they choose to take a different path regardless, because if they weren't informed on them, I would be even more concerned. I believe that they are informed, but they're choosing at the moment to take a different path. And perhaps they're thinking, oh, well, look, we'll deal with this tomorrow. You know?
I was at the airport in Brisbane the other night and bumped into a bloke, who I'm sure is a conservative voter, who heads one of our major suppliers of electricity. And he was telling me that the recent decisions by the federal government have absolutely stopped alternative energy investment overnight in this country. He was boggled by the impact of these decisions.
Well, that's right. Ian McFarlane in that leaked memorandum said that, you know, last year, that investment in alternative energy and renewables was going too fast. So we can see that as some sort of deliberate government policy. I think it personally, it's an utterly disastrous one. I mean, what stands between us and what many people believe is the collapse of the climate system as we know it is 531 gigatons of CO2. That's our budget out to 2040. And unless we can live within that budget and extend it out to 2060 or 70, you know, the shining technological fixes on the horizon like hydrogen and nuclear fusion and geosequestration are not going to arrive in time to save us.
Mm. You use budgetary terms a lot in your writings these days. You'd say that ever since 86... we've been running the environmental equivalent of a budget deficit, which can only be sustained by plundering the capital made available in the natural world. How close are we to total bankruptcy, or are we in receivership already?
If we were a company, we'd be looking like we're in receivership. The reason is that we're eating into that capital base at about, we're 20% over the was at the moment. You know, and in a couple of decades, we'll be somewhere closer to 30, 40, 50% in deficit. Now, companies at that operating at that level would be in receivership. We, in a sense, have got by because the environment isn't reacting as a whole to this collapse yet. There's been some absolute disaster areas, and one of them being the atmosphere. But we are building in a huge burden for future generations to repay in terms of, you know, rectifying those problems.
The CEO of a major corporation these days, whether national or international, is on a contract. The contract is usually fairly brief. Even if that CEO fails, he then leaves with an enormous golden handshake, walks away with probably making more money by being sacked than he would if he stayed on. This seems to be the case with the world leaders, that although we're bankrupt, although we're in receivership, they meet their short-term requirements, you know, bottom line or re-election, however you like to choose it. Why is it that the myriad critics, the shareholders of these vast enterprises, the citizens, aren't making their voices louder, or if they are loud, why aren't they making them heard?
I think that a lot of short-term issues intervene, and in Australia and the US particularly, we've got a couple of conservative governments that have been very good at playing the politics of fear. And when people are scared, they tend to make different decisions than they do if they are more relaxed and are taking a longer-term view. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a deliberate policy. It may be simply as a result of the times. But whatever the case there, what we're seeing is a neglect of these very dangerous long-term trends. So, you know, Alfred Russel Wallace said it, you know, in 1803. He said, don't vote for anyone who says it can't be done or won't be done. Only vote for those who say it will be done. And he was talking about pollution of the atmosphere and the environment.
But hang on. Yes, the politics of fear is dazzlingly manipulated. It fulfills so many short-term political requirements. But surely the fear of destroying the planet should override in the public consciousness and in the minds of decent political practitioners should overmind all of this.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And look, could I just contrast the US and Australia just for a bit on this, because they are rather different and it really illustrates the problem rather well. You know, in the US we've got a government that will go out of its way to damage the environment or, you know, irritate environmentalists, and that's really brought about this crisis of confidence in the environmental movement in the US. And that's driven in part by these beliefs that, you know, environmentalism is bad either for business or it's immoral, or you can destroy your local environment and still be a patriot, as some of these people believe.
Or that people like you are evil priests of a new paganism.
That's right, yeah. So, but these are alien views to most Australians, and we can laugh at them at a distance, you know. They're quite horrible when you get close up to them, but we can say that's someone else's problem. What we've got in Australia is, in the Howard government, a government that's done some, I think, quite extraordinary things for the environment. Protecting a third of the Great Barrier Reef, for example, was a brave political act in anyone's terms. Now, we can all argue that climate change is going to destroy the reef anyway and the government's doing nothing about that. Nevertheless, we're not dealing with a government in the Howard government like the Bush administration. The Tasmanian forest outcome was another thing. You know, it may not have gone far enough for many, but, you know, as an objective observer, you'd have to say it's good for the environment. What we have here, though, is a government that has a very great interest. It's a very dry economic view, a view that the economic decisions, you know, your first imperative is to protect the Australian economy. We have an economy that's structured around coal, at least as far as energy production goes, and mineral exports. And so people are unwilling to touch the great nub of the problem, the great centre of the climate change problem that will destroy everything else. And I find that very short term, because if you look at Australia's energy assets, we've got, you know, 40% of the world's uranium. We've got one of the world's best wind provinces. We've got the world's best geothermal province. We've got, you know, photovoltaics. We've got insulation, sunlight, more than you could ever, you know, want to use. You know, if we played our cards right, we as Australians would be the new energy czars of the renewable economy, of the new economy. Instead, what we're doing is holding on to this old economy and year by year losing strategic advantage. You can see it with our manufacturing, with our energy production. We're locked into this old fossil economy that doesn't have a future. And that's very, very disturbing. So I don't think as an environmentalist in Australia we're dealing with necessarily a government like the Bush administration. We're dealing with one whose ideology, whose particular orientation in terms of their thinking about the economy in the future doesn't let them see far enough ahead.
Okay, contrast that with the US now.
In the US, what we have is a government that's driven very much by contingency, by the far right, people like Pat Robertson and others, who are deeply antagonistic to the environment and to anything left-wing at all.
And aren't they in turn, though, driven also by the petrochemical industry?
I'm not so sure. Look, I think that's an important part of it. I think industry as a whole doesn't want to see higher energy prices, and they push that. But both Australia and the US have the same problem there. We've both got the same pressures. What we see more in the US is this deeply divided society. You know, whenever I travel to Washington now, that the intense hatred that I become exposed to the Bush government initiatives, is just has to be felt to be believed. And the same is true of the right wing. As soon as a group like, for example, the wind industry criticises the Bush government, they are cut out forever, right? So no more support, no coverage. It is a civil war starting to develop between the two parts of American society. It may not be a shooting war yet, but it's a palpable war. We haven't got to that stage in Australia, and we can't let things get to that stage in Australia. We're too small a society for that.
Well, you organised an extraordinary publicity stunt recently called Hurricane Katrina. What is it going to do? Is it a wind of change, do you think, for the United States?
If I could just take a minute to explain the relationship between those hurricanes and climate change, because it's really important we understand this. Once the surface of the sea gets above a certain temperature, it will generate hurricanes, and that temperature is about 23.7 degrees. For most of this summer and the summer before, the northern Gulf of Mexico, surface temperatures there of the ocean have been about 30 degrees. So this has been a catastrophe just waiting to happen, right? Last year we had four very devastating hurricanes in a row in the state of Florida. This year we had the earliest hurricane on record. Now we've got the most expensive natural disaster ever to hit America. And the hurricane season isn't finished yet, right? Sea surface temperatures are still high and will remain high now and into next year. The reason they're high is that all of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are trapping heat, which is being rapidly transferred into the oceans. And in Australia, I'm deeply worried that we'll have the similar sort of problems. The Great Barrier Reef is dying at the moment because the temperature of the sea is getting too high. That same temperature will end up spawning hurricanes and tornadoes and cyclones off the Australian coast. In fact, in January this year, we had a Category 5 cyclone heading for Cairns. Thankfully, it veered to the north. You know, the cyclone that destroyed Darwin in 1974 was a Category 3 cyclone.
Mm.
And is there a building in Cairns that could withstand a direct hit by a Category 5 cyclone? I don't think so. How many people would we be looking at, dead or evacuated in North Queensland, were we hit with a cyclone like that? In the thousands, maybe tens of thousands. But that, you know, while that sea surface temperature remains high, the capacity to generate those great storms will continue to persist. And we can't change that. In terms of our climate change decisions now, the gas is in the air. We can't take that gas back out. What we're fighting for now, Philip, as we talk about climate change, is to stop those high sea surface temperatures reaching further south. When I'm 70 or when my kids are in their prime, I don't want to see sea surface temperatures that high off Sydney or Brisbane.
Okay, there they are. We've got two Gulf Wars and one distracting from the other. We've got this phenomenon occurring, and it's bombarding the US coast. Is it a big enough event scientifically to jolt even the idiots out of their complacency?
I don't think that event will jolt the idiots out of their complacency, because what they'll do is look back at the cyclone record for North America and they'll see that there's been periods of high activity and periods of low activity as sea currents have brought warm and cold water off the coast. And of course, even though George Bush has already said that humans are impacting on the climate through putting these gases in the atmosphere, I've heard very little discussion of the origins of these extreme weather events in the US media. I'm hearing a lot of it in the British media, but not in the US media, so I think people are still in denial. It may take three or four hits or a longer season for people to start realising.
Earlier in the week, Tim, we had we did a program on the impact on New Orleans, and it was a deeply moving one because one of the three guests was the editor of a New Orleans paper, which is no longer exists, and he's now one of the more affluent refugees. And it was a heartbreaking thing to just listen to this decent, civilized, subtly intelligent human being talking about what's going on. He was joined by a bloke who's been trying to tell America for years that the levees aren't the solution to the problem, they're a part of the problem, and that what's happened in that neck of the woods is an ecological catastrophe in terms of draining wetlands, in terms of reconfiguring the coast and getting rid of buffer zones, you know, to hurricanes happening. It seems to me that all of a sudden people are listening to people like that environmentalist. Certainly people who are interested in the environment are. Will it get through? Will it get through to the hard heads?
I'd hope so, but, you know, I just have to say that the story you just told is the story of the world writ large. You know, the reason people used those wetlands and destroyed the buffers was that there was short-term advantage in it for them, you know?
Mm.
And yet that came at a great cost to the region, you know? The same is true for climate change, you know? There's a short-term advantage for Australia in using coal to fuel its economy, you know? But in the long term, it's disastrous.
Let's take the emphasis off the bad Republicans and put it onto the good Liberals. In your piece in the New York Review, you quote an address presented at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco in December 2004 by Adam Werbach, who was only 23 when he became president of the Sierra Club. And he talks about the movement's failure as a part of a broader social shift. Our death, he means the death of the environmental movement, is a symptom of the exhaustion of the liberal project. Having achieved its goals of basic economic rights, liberalism and its special interests now fail to speak to the modern need for fulfilment of the American people. Now, I think that's less true here, isn't it?
I think so. When I read that, I found myself feeling somewhat sceptical because it didn't resonate with me. I mean, to me, Australians are not driven by the same need for that wealth and security. They don't share that ideology as much that is so prevalent in North America and particularly the US. What I see here is more people interested in a sea change, you know, more people interested in leading a good life. And you do see that in the US, but, you know, with those with that imperative just to keep going economically over there, perhaps he's right. Perhaps liberalism has come up against an immovable obstacle of what is effectively poverty, you know, or hard-edged economic reality.
If we go back to the quote I didn't identify its source. Let me go back to a quote I used at the beginning. It's Harvey Blatt writing in America's Environmental Report Card, and he's talking about the fears or the beliefs that Americans hold about environmental regulation. The rules cause widespread unemployment, that regulation leads to plant shutdowns and unemployment, and that environmental regulation causes companies to build new plants overseas. None of those things are true, are they?
No, absolutely not. And that was the point he was making, raising them. Most Americans believe they are true. None of them, in fact, are true. And again, I was thinking, you know, if I asked Australians those same questions, would I get anything like that answer?
No.
No, absolutely. I mean, we live the reality of improving environmental conditions and see that we've still got a booming economy, you know. That's not the case in the US for some reason.
Why don't the Democrats do a better job? You quote extensively and generously from one of the Kennedys who's made this his life work. But why do the Democrats run dead on this? I mean, here's Kennedy saying in his book Crimes Against Nature, if they knew the truth, most Americans would share my fury that this president is allowing his corporate cronies to steal America from our children. Good rhetoric, that.
It is. And why isn't it biting? Look, I've lived in America for long enough to know I don't understand the country well enough. To me, it all rings true, you know, that the democratic message that's coming across is just so common sense. And yes, sometimes you feel it hasn't gone far enough. But why it's failing to bite in the American heartland is the great question for the world. I don't know, maybe we should have Bob Silvers on from the New York Review to ask him what he thinks.
You and I had an off-mic conversation quite recently, and you were particularly angry at the time, and particularly apocalyptic. And I share your concerns, as you know. But you said that even in Australia, you felt the political system was so enfeebled or so deeply in denial on this issue, even in Australia, that you sometimes felt like starting a new political party.
Yeah, that's right. You do feel desperate when you've lived with this issue of this impending environmental crisis for so long and seen how feeble our responses have been. It is frustrating. You probably caught me on a bad day, Philip, thinking about that. When I look at the US and then look at my own country here, you realise that we have got some advantages, and I think things can be done politically here. I mean, to be absolutely objective about it. But what's really important is changing people, you know. It's every one of us, by turning on that light every day or driving a bigger car, we're the ones who are creating the problem. So in a sense, this is a different sort of environmental problem from, say, saving the forests in Tasmania that you can only do through political action. So more and more I'm focusing on individual people and just saying, what sort of world do you want to leave for your kids and do you want to be living in 20 years' time? There's some really painless things you can do to make sure that it's a better outcome than the one we're looking at now.
Well, let's tell people some of those things in just a minute. But first of all, I'd like to thank the listener for spending one of their few remaining hours with Late Night Live on Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, or downloadable via MP3. Is that what it's called? Thank you very much. I'm just asking my producers. MP3, that's what it is. And I'm talking to one of the most useful of our citizens in Tim Flannery. Tim, you've cast a wide net in your intellectual and academic scientific life. You've been interested in almost everything. But more and more, you've decided that this is the issue that you wish to devote most of your energies to.
Yeah, that's right. Look, I'd love to be working in New Guinea again, doing more faunal survey work, or perhaps doing some paleontology in Australia. And in a sense, my interest in climate change and the environmental crisis has come out of that long view of history and what you see, you know, in places like New Guinea. But this is the big issue, and in a sense, this is the issue that has to be solved during the remainder of my working lifetime, because if we don't address this issue over the next 10 to 20 years, we won't have the luxury of dealing with the other issues, the other very urgent ones like biodiversity loss and soil degradation and whatever else. You know, so that's why I'm focusing more and more on this particular issue.
You end your New York Review piece by borrowing from the New York Times. The long-term threat of climate change. The president has succeeded in turning what might have been a powerful commitment by the industrialized nations to confront global warming into diplomatic mush. And your comment is, the question remains whether scientists, environmentalists, and the rest of the international community can muster the political power to compel the American political establishment to address this problem. You say you're stressing American for two reasons, aren't you? One, you're talking to an American audience. But two, at the moment, it is driven by the mighty American economy rather than the Chinese or the Indian who are coming on stream.
That's right. About 20% of the emissions that are leading to this climate change problem are generated in America, 20 to 25%. And they are the single biggest block we need to move on. You know, there's four Kyoto renegades, really. There's Australia, the US, Monaco and Liechtenstein. And two of those countries you don't need to worry about too much. The other two, we have to move on to addressing fairly and squarely, either inside or outside of Kyoto, this issue of those 531 gigatons of CO2 that stand between us and disaster.
Tim, whenever I despair of the future and think, well, God, once 1.2 billion Chinese and 1.2 billion Indians start polluting on that same scale, we are completely rooted. But I've had guests on the program recently who insist that the Chinese, for example, are taking these problems very seriously, and with the advantage of the centralized economy, or to some extent a higher degree of central control than you get in democracies, they are in fact taking some of the right steps. Is that your impression?
It certainly is. Those countries have ratified the Kyoto Protocol. They know how exposed they are to climate change with those very large populations in limited regions and regions that are subject already to flood and other sort of environmental disasters. And they are already influencing the American juggernaut in their own way. And just to give you one example of that, this new pact, Asia-Pacific Pact on Clean Development and Climate Change, the Americans have gone out of their way to say that this is not a challenge to Kyoto. This is actually to work and complement with Kyoto. The Australians are giving the opposite message. They're out there saying this is Kyoto's in its death throes and whatever else. The reasons the Americans are taking that softly view is the Chinese and the Indians simply wouldn't have been part of it had the Americans decided to use it to try to nobble Kyoto further.
There's a list of things that we can do, which I will dwell on shortly, but one of the things that people can do is stop having so many people. And yet this debate's off the boiler. It's off, well, certainly off the front burner. Ehrlich is still around, insisting that it should be up front and personal. What do you think about population how important is it in the multifactorial equation?
Well, look, it's hugely important, but it's such a long-term thing. It's like the Titanic. You know, trying to turn around population figures takes decades. And we don't want to do it like the Chinese and institute one-child families and have skewed sex ratios and things. That would be a disaster. The problem
I'm
with
sorry,
this,
why would it be a disaster?
Oh, just because you'd have, a worse demographic pyramid than we've got at the moment. You know, we'd have lots and lots of old people, relatively few young people. A sex ratio of it's nearly 1.2, I think, boys to girls. I mean, God, who'd want to live in a society like that? I like the girls, you know. So anyway, it's for all sorts of reasons you wouldn't want to go down that path. And the other thing is the timelines are too short. I mean, we have to deal with this climate change problem in the next 2 decades. There's nothing we can do in terms of population that's going to help us do that. So in a way, we've got to live with the inbuilt population juggernaut that we've got. And thankfully, with the work of Paul Ehrlich and others, has slowed down the rate of population increase. And we're now looking at a maximum population mid-century of around 8.9 billion, maybe a little bit less.
That's the hypothetical or the theoretical peak. Is it?
That's right, yeah. The latest figures suggest that's about the peak. And half of that has come about through good practice and the work that Ehrlich's been promoting for many years now.
So the population bomb did have a good effect. That's
right,
Ehrlich's book.
It did. That's right. Well, half of that stabilisation comes from that. The other half, unfortunately, comes from the AIDS epidemic in Africa. So, you know, half through misery and misplanning and part through the good work of people like Paul Ehrlich.
And of course, if climate change, if its rate accelerates, which is, I think, a given, that is also going to have quite catastrophic effects on the human population, but not enough to self-correct in a cruel and appalling way.
Well, I think that there is very good argument that climate change could destroy our civilization, and I don't say that lightly. If you look at the impact of one large tropical storm on a city like New Orleans, you can see that cities can't move. They can't get up and go to somewhere else that's safer, nor can they extend their routes infinitely that bring them water and food and whatever else. We're talking here about this extraordinary telekinetic atmosphere that changes instantaneously and globally in response to this forcing by increased warming. It can deprive whole regions of rainfall. We've seen it already in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, it can bring storms of such intensities that no cities can withstand them. And this is the beginning. This is 0.6 of a degree of warming. We're looking at 3 degrees of warming by the end of this century as an average.
And people don't understand this. They seem to think that the temperatures go up and then sort of plateau. That is not what happens, is it? They just keep remorselessly moving up.
That's right. And, you know, 0.6 of a degree sounds small, but it is a huge shift in one century. You know, we're now looking at rates of change 30 times as great at least as those we saw at the end of the last ice age when the glaciers retreated and the world reorganised itself. So these are very rapid and very large-scale changes that do threaten civilization. I mean, civilization, the word itself, comes from citizens and cities, you know. And those sort of climate shifts are a threat to these great complex organisms that most of us live in.
One of the first times you came to American attention was when you were telling them about their own glacial history. And I remember reading your stuff with astonishment. and that was the scale of the icing up of North America. Would you remind the listener how epic it was?
Well, look, 15,000 years ago, which is not very long ago at all, you know, given that Egypt was around 4,000 years ago, there was enough ice frozen on the North American continent alone to lower sea levels by 74 metres. Now, just think about that. An ice cap 4 kilometres thick with enough water frozen in it to lower the sea level right around the world by 74 metres.
How far did that cap extend?
It extended right down to New York, to Manhattan. You know, if you go into Central Park today, you can look at the rocks and see the scrape marks left on it by that ice as it retreated about 14,000 years ago. Mm. You know, north of Boston, you can see a piece of rock two-thirds the size of Ayers Rock that was carried there from Canada 15,000 years ago by a massive glacier. I mean, these are big changes.
The trouble with that sort of information is that it makes people feel that human intervention, our stuff-ups, really don't add much to the great cycles.
Oh, I suppose that's true. And it's always difficult, isn't it, saying to people we live in an inherently uncertain and, you know, unstable world, which it is. I mean, in the fullness of geological time, it's, you know, unstable. But what people are doing to it now is greatly increasing that instability.
What was that acceleration figure you mentioned, 30 times?
About 30. The rate of change we're seeing now with climate change is 30 times as fast as the rate we saw when all of that ice melted. You know, we saw 5 degrees of change over 7,000 years there. We're looking at least around 3 degrees of change over a century now. So they're very, very big numbers.
Can you give me a country other than China where environmental policy in all its manifestations is well executed?
Well, look, Great Britain is the place that I think we should look to. And the reason is that the very first political leader to address the issue of climate change was Margaret Thatcher, who was advised by the gayer man, Lovelock. And we've seen with Blair a continuation of that policy and a real commitment to reducing emissions. Britain now is producing 20% less CO2 than it was 20 or 30 years ago,
is
and yet its
so?
Economy has grown by 37%.
So and it's a highly developed, in fact, many would say, totally mature and rapidly aging population that have brought that off. And of course, we should also remember that there was a fairly successful attempt at cleaning up rivers, certainly the Thames, and that the pea soup fogs, those toxic fogs which characterised London life and life in other cities, were got rid of by changing policies about what you could burn in the fireplace.
That's right, about energy policy. And it's amazing, isn't it, that those fogs have been around so long, the British or the Londoners particularly had a sort of perverse pride in them. So I think there was some sort of wistfulness when they vanished.
Mm.
But anyway, it's left a better world.
So you can, in fact, affect change by decent legislation and by collective effort. It isn't all over Red Rover. We can save ourselves.
Well, look, absolutely. I think, as I said, the next 10 or 20 years will decide the outcome.
Okay, you're elected Prime Minister in a remarkable turn of political events, but of course these things happen. What are you going to do in our country before we get you elected President?
All right. First thing I do, put on a carbon tax. Start it small, but signal it's going to grow in future. Now, what that will do will shift investment away from the old economy, from the coal-based economy, into the renewables. And I would develop a portfolio of assets, those energy assets, which would run from nuclear to hot rocks to wind to photovoltaics. And just to give you an idea of how big they are, the hot rocks province in Australia, the geothermal province, there's enough potential energy there to fuel all of Australia's energy needs for the next 70 years. I mean, that is a big, big asset. We've got the third best wind province in the world. And again, why can't we grow that? Why can't we start making an industry of that? We've got very innovative new photovoltaics technology here in South Australia called sliver cell technology. And, of course, more sunlight than you can poke a stick at. We've got some great solar thermal technology coming on board. All of these things could potentially make us the new energy czars in the new economy. And my great fear for my country is that we're going to ignore all of that and we're going to stick with this dying economy of fossil fuels, which can have no future. Either it goes or we go. So as Prime Minister, I'd make sure it goes and we go on to a better future.
Tim, 30 years ago, I had a dinner with Macfarlane Burnet, our Nobel laureate, or one of them, and Ralph Nader, Barry Jones and others, and Mac Burnet was trying to demonstrate the solar option. He was fairly dismissive of other renewables. He didn't think much of wind, and he was worried about tidal power making the moon crash on the earth. But what he said was, and he drew a diagram on the tablecloth, that if we had a solar collector stuck up in the Nullarbor, 100 miles by 100 miles in size, it theoretically would collect enough power, enough solar power, for the whole world. 30 years ago, nothing like that's happened. Solar, which we have, in almost infinite abundance, hasn't kicked off even here.
Well, when Macfarlane Burnet was giving those opinions, the US was the world leader in photovoltaic technology, you know, in the 1970s. They're now followers, you know, and that is because the existing interest groups, those who already have the high ground, have successfully influenced government policy to make sure that they stay on top, but to the great detriment of the planet. You know, when I think about this sometimes, I think about the Titanic, you know, the sinking of the ship and people reaching for the gold chest, you know, as the ship's going down. So reaching for some money as all around them is being lost. And I just think, how do you change that? And to be fair, if I can say about the big corporations, some of them are absolutely in the lead. I mean, BP has been brilliant. And Lord Brown has been one of the truly inspirational leaders in this area and one of the people who will change the world. Other companies.
So the corporation is not essentially the enemy. It can, in fact, be the ally.
That's absolutely right. Look, there are a lot of people going to get very rich out of this new energy economy. You know, there's no doubt about that. Every shift in the energy economy has brought enormous wealth, whether it's from coal to oil, oil now into gas, or gas as it will be into renewables. Each one of those is going to bring huge wealth to a new group of people. And I just hope our country is up there doing it. And, of course, you can do good by doing good. You know, that's what I'd like to see.
Before you leave the lodge and we get you into the White House, are there any other policy decisions you want to implement? Would you pull cattle farming out of great regions of Australia and things like that?
I'd make sure that every piece of legislation I was putting in was put through a humanist sieve or put under the humanist microscope to make sure that it reflected, and you know, everything I said to reflected truly that every individual is a valuable person and has to be respected regardless of who they are or where they're from. And that first and foremost, you've got to have that right. Otherwise, you won't have a healthy society that'll allow you to maintain your democracy and all of those other things you need to do.
So you'd steer massive change through community discussion and try to get consensus.
I don't know. Sometimes you've got to be brave and get out there and do that, but you want to make sure that all of your policy and all of your pronouncements are really focused around that fundamental recognition that there are a group of human rights that we all possess, and there's a level of respect we need to accord every single individual, regardless of where they're from, and regardless of whether we're fearful of them or whatever else. We just have to make sure that those things that are they're the underpinnings of our society are reflected in everything you do. Because I think if you lose that, like we've seen in the US, you know, if you start getting great disparities of wealth or you start breaking down that fundamental respect, then you've lost something that really is your future.
I am talking to the windmilled, tidal-powered Tim Flannery. Tim uses absolutely no fossil fuels in his performances, and he's appearing on the solar-powered Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and the World Wide Web. Oh, and that MP3 download, Bizzo. Let's get down to what the ordinary Australian, and hopefully one day the ordinary American, can do, short of massive changes in legislation. Does it really matter if we... does it really help if we recycle our newspapers and bottles and turn off the odd light switch, or is this just social therapy?
It really helps. It really helps. Like I said, this crisis is one that we all create individually. And so by doing something like turning off your light switch, it has a big impact. And can I give you two examples of that are really important? One is to do with hot water. Now, you'd think that sounds like such a silly thing, don't you? But when I look at it, I see these great big water kettles sitting in everyone's roof using burning coal to keep this water hot, that we only use a little bit of at a time.
And then we cool it down very often, don't we?
Yeah, we do. I mean,
in the shower, we then mix it with cold water because it's too bloody hot.
That's right. And then you insulate your roof to keep the heat from the sun out of your house. Why not put a solar hot water system on your roof, save 30% of your electricity bill? So, you know, I've just done it and halved my bill, which is quite extraordinary. And the payback time's only a couple of years. And these systems have now got a 12-year guarantee, so you get 8 or 10 years of free hot water.
So it really is a significant contributor to a better outcome.
What you're doing then is cutting your emissions by 30%. Now, what the scientists tell us is we need to cut our emissions by 70% as a society, overall that is, by 2050. So in one day you can do 30%. If you drive a four-wheel drive car and you trade it in for a hybrid fuel car, you're cutting your transport emissions by 70% in one day.
Yeah, but hang on, Tim, I think the hybrid cars, that sounds terrific, but then I read not entirely irrational people saying, hang on, because of the technology involved in the hybrid car, because of the batteries, the rechargeable batteries, the ultimate cost of a hybrid car is higher than that of an ordinary petrol or diesel.
You're talking about monetary cost or environmental cost?
Environmental cost in manufacture.
I haven't seen that justified anywhere. I think over the life of the vehicle, you're making enormous emission savings. But even if you don't want to buy, you know, if you don't want to have a family-sized car, which is a hybrid, say a Prius or the Honda Civic, what you can do is go and buy yourself a 600cc car. You know, so you're getting the same fuel economy, but with a smaller vehicle. After all you want really is the transport. Yeah, that's the first and foremost what you buy a car for. And when you look at those big impacts you can have, you know, sell your four-wheel drive, buy either a hybrid or a small car, in one day you can cut your transport emissions by 70%. So don't tell me that society can't make these changes. When we decide to act, these changes will come very quickly. And that's my view. It'll be all over Redrover. We'll make the shift to the new energy economy. And we'll do it relatively effortlessly and at little cost.
Has the suburban ritual, the religious rite of recycling bottles and papers, has that been worth the effort?
Look, I haven't really done a whole-of-life study of that sort of stuff, but by and large you would have to say yes. And I can't really justify that beyond saying, you know, the cost in fossil fuel of digging a huge pit, putting all of this stuff in and then having it emit methane for the next century or so is pretty high. And then, of course, manufacturing it all anew. So, you know, short-circuiting that by recycling is a really important element, I think, although I haven't got the figures before me to be able to justify that feeling.
Of course, scientists are on their bikes metaphorically, if not physically, and as you point out in your New York Review piece, barely a week passes without some significant contribution to the subject appearing in the world's leading science journals. There's an awful lot of people out there trying to improve the situation or lower the level of crisis with technological fixes, isn't there?
There is, and there's a lot of activity going on. I mean, for the long-term technologies, you know, the stuff that we might like to see, such as the hydrogen economy or nuclear fusion or geosequestration of coal, they're not going to come in time to make any difference to the climate outcome. You know, it's another lot of technologies, really the existing technologies that are going to save us. I mean, solar hot water's been around for 30 years. We just haven't had the uptake. Same with photovoltaics. Wind power's been around the same time. You know, it's the existing technologies that have to carry us and efficiency gains that have to carry us.
You mentioned nuclear fusion, and we should point out to the listener you're talking fusion, not fission.
That's good.
And if fusion does kick in at some point, we don't have a nuclear waste problem with that, do we?
No, that's correct. We don't. But that technology is not going to happen in my lifetime. We may have it in a century's time, but it's not going to happen.
Why has it taken such an extraordinary length of time? Because I can remember in the 50s and the 60s, quite bright scientists were saying we'd see it within 20 years.
Well, it's containing this plasma that they create, which is exceptionally high temperature. I think the technical difficulties of dealing with this stuff is so great that people haven't been able to make the breakthroughs that are required. I'm no expert in that area of the debate, but from what I understand from people who are experts is that we're still a very long way away from being able to generate that limitless power from that source.
What about fission? How do you feel about that as a power source?
If you look at the nuclear industry as it's developed, it's a complex question, but can I divide it into two bits? if you look at it in Australia, I don't think we're going to have a nuclear power generation in Australia until we get a very different sort of configuration. The reason is that, you know, the costs of building nuclear power are high, the power stations themselves are very large. If we had one in Australia, it'd have to be between Melbourne and Sydney to fit in with the grid, and maybe near Canberra somewhere, maybe on Parliament House, who knows. But wherever it is, it'd have to be down in that corner of the country somewhere, and you'd have all of your energy eggs in one basket. I think for a number of reasons that's undesirable. Places like India and China, though, are going to go ahead and build lots of nuclear capacity. I hope they use the latest technologies, things like the pebble bed reactors or the pressurised water reactors that are very efficient and can't go into criticality, can't go into meltdown. But the temptation will always be to buy cheap off-the-shelf solutions, so we shall see how that develops. You know, Australia's got 40% of uranium ores here in most of it in South Australia. So we need to develop some very good policy around minimising the risks of using that ore in this new carbon-constrained world that we're entering.
It may, in fact, be a cure which is no worse than the disease, if it's properly done.
Look, I am no less fearful of nuclear energy now than I was a decade ago when I protested against it. But what I recognise now is that there is a far, far greater threat, and that is the continued burning of coal. So we need to move on from that. I guess in an ideal world, what I'd be suggesting was that Australia developed its own nuclear industry where we mined the ore, we made the rods or the pebbles, we leased them out to people overseas, then brought the waste back in and responsibly dealt with that waste. And
what's Synrock looking like these days? That CSIRO idea of waste storage, is that...
My understanding is there's been very little development over the last few years on that. And there are some significant energy costs involved, but with the price of uranium increasing, that doesn't appear to be a barrier. So I think the most responsible thing to do would be to lease that energy source if you want and take it back and make sure it doesn't fall into the hands of terrorists. And then you can also have some control over how it's used. You know, the big problems for the nuclear industry are, you know, the problem of making bombs, the stuff being used for warfare, human error, and then, you know, structural errors, problems with the actual, you know, physical reactors themselves.
I forgot to congratulate you on being the Australian Humanist of the Year for 2005, Tim.
Well, thank you
well
very
deserved,
much.
Well deserved, mate.
That meant more to me than anything I think any government could give me, because it is very kind of central to the way I tend to think about the world.
Indeed it is. Tell me about the book that I'll be discussing with you shortly.
The book on climate change?
Yep. How far advanced is it?
It'll be launched on the 26th of September in Sydney. It really is my attempt to write a manual for Earth's thermostat, a manual people can actually use, you know. So it presents the great scope of the problem and the history of the problem, and this amazing, talks a little bit about this extraordinary atmosphere that we all crawl around on the bottom of, you know, this great aerial ocean. Amazing thing, I think. And then goes on really to just lay out as clearly as I can the things that can be done and that can be done easily, which will avert this growing problem.
Thank you to the Director of the South Australian Museum and Professor at the University of Adelaide, Tim Flannery. Tim's new book, The Weather Makers, The History and Future Impact of Climate Change, will be published on the 26th of September by Text Publishing. On our next, we'll be talking to an archaeologist who's discovered people with a special genius for plumbing, for getting the most out of minuscule rainfall. It may come in handy. Stick around now on Radio National for the news.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.